This is the message from the Sri Aurobindo Ashram released today. In the mind, one may have a strong admiration or appreciation for the intellectual or spiritual greatness of the Guru, follow him and mentally accept his dictates. But if it is merely mental, that does not carry you very far. Of course, there is no harm in having that also, but by itself it does not open the whole of the inner being. It only establishes a mental contact. Psychic bhakti is not like that. Because it is in communication with the divinity behind, it is capable of true bhakti. Psychic bhakti does not make any demand. It makes no reservations. It is satisfied with its own existence. The psychic being knows how to obey the truth in the right way. It gives itself up truly to God or the Guru, and because it can give itself up truly, therefore it can also receive truly. Sri Aurobindo. And you'll all get this lovely darshan card. After our talk and meditation. This morning, I opened with the life divine. I'd like to do that again. Today is the birthday, 100 years ago, of the journal, the Arya, Sri Aurobindo's Philosophical Review. He opens with two selections from the Rig Veda. I'll let you read those on your own, but he counts them as the affirmations of Vedanta. And they figure, interestingly, the great Rishi Kutsa Angirasa, who plays an important role in establishing the consanguinity between the human aspirant, and the God who leads to the divine mentality. Kutsa. came first. Then Sri Aurobindo writes, in this opening essay, The Life Divine, the earliest preoccupation of man in his awakened thoughts, and as it seems his inevitable and ultimate preoccupation, for it survives the longest periods of skepticism and returns after every banishment, is also the highest which his thought can envisage. It manifests itself in the divinization of Godhead, the impulse towards perfection, the search after pure truth and unmixed bliss, the sense of a secret immortality. The ancient dawns of human knowledge have left us their witness to this constant aspiration. Today, we see a humanity satiated but not satisfied by victorious analysis of the externalities of nature, preparing to return to its primeval longings. The earliest formula of wisdom promises to be its last: God, light, freedom, immortality. There is much that went into the preparation of that first paragraph. It is indeed the affirmation of Vedanta. The end of the Veda, in the sense that it's the culmination of the Veda. You'll know Sri Aurobindo began yoga in 1904 with the practice of pranayama, and it brought him a great mental light, prakasha. He found, interestingly, that he had much more energy, that he could write hundreds of lines of poetry when he used to struggle to write a dozen. But he set that practice of pranayama aside because he couldn't be consistent with it, and it led to physical illness. He recovered after about half a year, but I think was then fascinated by the prospect of what yoga might bring. He wanted power, he wanted energy with which to liberate India, to throw off the British yoke. He was guided, we might say, to seek a guru who could teach him something about yoga. He met Vishnu Bhaskar Lele, who said, can you give me 3 days of your time? And Sri Aurobindo said, with all this political work, how can I do that? He said, well, when you can find 3 days, then I'll work with you. Sri Aurobindo found the 3 days, and they went to a roof in Baroda, which belonged to a friend, and he was directed to look at thoughts as they were coming outside. Be calm, still your mind, and watch. And you'll see these thoughts come whirling in from outside. Sri Aurobindo had never thought of that idea, but he did just as he was told. He didn't know he couldn't still his mind, so he stilled his mind. And slowly, one thought after another appeared, and he would knock them down, one after the other. He's modest, really. His enlightenment was instantaneous. But to make it thoroughgoing, to make it permanent, so that there couldn't be a wave or a ripple, it took him 3 days to establish that silence completely. But then the great question was how to continue with a political career, because he still had demands and calls for his speeches. So, in that state of vacancy, in which only the nameless that was vivid, all the universe was blown out. There was no self any longer. It was only that. Still, he managed to continue to be active. Not to reject action, activity, world, but to accept it and work within it. Slowly, that vacancy built into a positive, and there was a great felicity in the vastness of that consciousness. So what we might call the passive Brahman was becoming the positive, the full Brahman, known to the Upanishad. So this Vedantic realization of the absolute naught, and this Vedantic realization of the fullness of reality, where it is Purna, both were in him, and yet more was to come, because when he was placed in confinement in the Alipur jail, it became the completing experience of personality behind all the play of phenomena. Because there wasn't simply this featureless vast. There was a being, an existent, who looked at him through the eyes of the warden, who was present in the tree in the garden, who was the wall, who was the judge. And that being, who was everywhere, omnipresent, said to him, "I've been waiting for you. I have work for you, and it is not the liberation politically of India. My work for you is the liberation of the human mind. I summarize, you'll forgive me." But Sri Aurobindo saw that the omnipresence is not a sheer impersonality alone, it is also a personality beyond the order of what we recognize. It's only the Gita which really gives us a sense of that. We're aware of the kind of personality we are, changing, shifting, never the same, never stable. We're aware, too, of the spiritual status where all of this seems uninteresting, transient, unreal. But there's another poise beyond the Kshara and the Akshara Purusha, and that is the Supreme Person, the Purushottama. Sri Aurobindo had this in the jail at Alipur. It was, as he called it, a trysting ground for the divine, who then undertook to show him how to fuse these two Vedantic realizations, the great personality, the absoluteness of Brahman, and use them as a foundation for something that went still farther, which is making the spirit dynamic, this fusion of Shiva Shakti, of Ishvara Ishwari, the consciousness and the power of that consciousness, could be installed in the being and our life transformed. And as he was made aware of this potentiality, a program, in a sense, revealed itself to him. And they weren't successive stamps. They were all meant to proceed together, but he listed them in a kind of order. First came Shanti, but equality, which led to a deepening peace, which led to a great laughter and joy. Peace is not absent feeling. Peace is the foundation of great feeling, of that ananda. Peace is a wave of ananda, but not the whole of it. But ananda must be present. And then power. One cannot change nature without power. So the fulfillment of the divine will, of the soul in matter, must be there. That is the Shakti side of the work. And then the Vijnana, the lifting of the mind into a greater light, ascending all the stairs of being until you reach the uppermost, so that you can see with the divine eye, you can act with the divine will, you can experience with the divine bliss, you can, in one glance, see the past, the present, the future, because really they are unpartite. And this supramentalization led, with the power and with the peace, to the work on the body, the sharira. So finally, of course, there is the karma, the necessity of the work in the world. There is the Brahma, where you have, in a sense, to work in complete solidarity with the surrounding omnipresent reality. And finally, the yoga, where the siddhi becomes fulfilled. But those first four steps call peace and power and light into the physique so that it can be changed. So you see Sri Aurobindo working steadily on this program and beginning to take careful notes about how it's going, as if this is a laboratory and he's working out an experiment and he's writing down everything that he does in careful handwriting, which he never used when he was writing correspondence. But when he came to this record of yoga, as we call it, he was punctilious, he was exact. And then, isn't it interesting that he sits there, a fulfilled, realized being, continuing to practice sadhana? Most people would quit. With one of those realizations, they would be satisfied. Sri Aurobindo kept going as if he was called forward. The true meaning of the Aryan is one who is effortfully moving forward, always aspiring. And he was the Aryan, and he was a rishi, a seer, truly. You can see him as a transplant almost from the Rig Veda, but into modern temperament, attire, and habitat. Sitting there in Pondicherry, this hot, sleepy French provincial city, if you could call it a city back then. Really, it was a township. And he's there like a Muni, like a sage. And he has a small group of renegade, rebellious young people around him, like the Vratyas we read about in the Vedas. These wild young boys who are going to go on a great escapade, who renounce all things until the escapade has been successful, like the hound chasing the cows, or like cattle raiders, which they were, the Indian cowboys. So he's there with these young boys, but fate is interesting because it brings to him, to Sri Aurobindo, an Indian, but educated in the West, at Cambridge. The cream of European culture exists in his being, and yet he has realized the great truths of Indian spirituality by this hour, when who comes to visit him but Paul and Mira Rishaw, in March of 1914, again, 100 years ago. This is the year of the centenary of their meeting and of their work together to bring out the journal Arya, because it was a meeting of soul and mind. They immediately said to Sri Aurobindo, you have this vision which should be shared with the world. Why don't we bring out a journal? It's like the little rascal saying, let's put on a show. And they manifest this journal within just a few months, working collaboratively. Paul and Mira representing a Western mind turning to Eastern light. Paul was himself a philosopher, a theologian, interested in the highest thought of European culture. Myrrha, whom we came to know as the mother later, had been schooled in Lurianic, Kabbalistic, Jewish mysticism, and had had fulfillment in that, had a cosmic vision of her own. So, pairing their intelligence and inner tact with Sri Aurobindo's mighty vision, they brought forward this journal. The Life Divine was the first article, but also Sri Aurobindo serialized in the Arya, the Synthesis of Yoga, Essays on the Gita, the Psychology of Social Development. And as he wrote, ...64 pages of philosophy after the first year, all by himself, there was forming in Pondicherry a new community, because the one wonderful thing that the mother brought with her was a sense of the pragmatic. Not only should we announce this, but we should demonstrate it. And so they formed a kind of new society. Europeans were part of it, the French, the Tamil Indian society, Bengalis. It was a mixture of many different kinds of people to form a new basis. It's as if the Vratyas are becoming Brahmanical. It's a pilot project which, after the Arya lies complete, then is the seed of a future ashram. But an ashram in the old sense, ashram in the oldest sense, because in those days when ashramas came into being in Vedic India, they were not places where renunciants gathered. Rather, they were places where people who felt the spiritual pitch so strongly in them that they needed to live together did so, but without renouncing life, but rather to fulfill life supremely. You see this in Sri Aurobindo also. He refused sannyasa. Sannyasa wasn't necessary for him to realize the divine. He had realized the divine while married, while engaged in a political career, while running a national college. Every activity that was possible to the human can be conducted, he demonstrated, in a spiritual consciousness. And that was what he wanted to share, that life can be perfected and does not have to be silenced, driven out, austerely rejected. Yes, one must realize first. That has to be the great goal of anyone who wants to be a member of this kind of community. If you want to be a member of an ashram, you have to be an arrow pointed at that target. That has to be your real goal. Everything else comes with it, but that is central. To discover yourself, to fulfill life through this discovered soul. And in that self-discovery, oneness with the world. With that self-discovery, making the future happen now. Why wait for this great wave of evolution to come? Let's go get it. We can't get it from mere egoistic striving. We can't get it because it sounds good. We can get it if we're willing, as the Isha Upanishad tells us, to renounce and then enjoy. To put aside personal satisfaction for divine satisfaction. Then the real person in you is fulfilled. You can only get to that if your ego is mature enough to attain it. And let's make something clear here. This is an evolution of consciousness, which is not meant to destroy nature or all the various stadia of existence which we have carefully built over millenniums, over eons. In the inner structure of the universe, the articulation of the sense of self, the ego, the ahamkara, the I maker, is a necessary function in the world. Without that, there is no centrality. There can be no pointed work. The thing is, just as you do not fully identify only with your body, or only with your life, or only with your mind, but realize that you are a soul which possesses and uses these instruments, so too you possess and you use that ego. The ego is not to be abolished, but it is not to be central. Sri Aurobindo, in writing in later years about ego, mentions that its utter disappearance, not its subsidence, its utter disappearance is only possible when the supramental consciousness has fully stationed itself in the being and manifested. Otherwise, there will always be the potentiality of ego, because it's part of the old nature, it's part of Prakriti. Until Prakriti has been, in a sense, replaced, or should we say displaced, by para-prakriti, by super-nature. It has a function, but it cannot be central. We don't do things for ourselves. We learn how to consecrate our work to the greater cause. That greater cause is the evolution of consciousness, the manifestation of light, to live in the delight behind pleasure and pain, to throw off the ignorance which binds us to the past, and thereby live in the freedom of the future, because that is what's calling us. Immortality is the nature of the soul. It is not something we have to struggle to find. If you realize your soul, you know immediately that this cannot die. It is impossible. It is a part of that, an aspect of that. And it is both in time and out of time. We can live in eternity. We can live in immortality and still do good, well-appointed work here and now in this very vehicle, the one that we have. It's perfect for us. Keep it well tuned. Change the oil. A century ago, Sri Aurobindo gave voice to that manifesto. God, light, freedom, immortality. All of those things we find first inside. We can found them outside in our dynamic life. But if we haven't found it inside, it is a vain dream. But it is not a dream. It is a conception that is pouring itself into the mold of earthly life. It will happen. We are moving towards that. The supramental consciousness will manifest. when we are ready for it. Live from the soul, less from the ego, open to the light, consecrating your work, doing your best, full of love, easy to compassion, and things will go well. What a wonderful destiny it is that brought the mother and Sri Aurobindo together to bring all polarities to point in this effort. What a wonderful thing that they could not simply announce, but form a pilot project which we can take up anywhere. We can reproduce wherever we are an ashram, because it starts from realization and moves out to sanctify and then to divinize life. Wherever you are the center of an ashram. You are the center of a world which can become divine. So work with that faith. Be open to her power and light. And you will be seeds of light, growing a new world. So, do good work. Be sincere. Always be happy. Jai Ma. Namaste. So we'll go and meditate now and come out and share prasadam and I'll distribute things to you.